Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. My name is Matt Spaeth, and with me is my co-host, Carol Gravet.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome, Carol. So,
thanks.
Food Integrity Now is, we're all about advocating integrity in our global food supply. And this is part three of our Growing Your Own Food series, In Harmony with Nature, with Evan Folds of Progress Earth. The topic today is indoor gardening. And we're excited about this topic because it's something that even people in the city can do if they don't have any soil. So, welcome Evan Folds back to the show.
Hey, how's everybody doing? Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. If you missed the first two parts, the first show was an introduction, and the second. The first part, and Evan was giving an overview of the different aspects of biodynamics and a brief overview of what is to come. And the second part is about how planning your own outdoor garden. So if that is what you're interested in, be sure to check that out in our archives. You can reach that on foodintegritynow.org. And, today we're getting into indoor gardening. So, Evan, what? Tell us about indoor gardening and why someone would want to get into it.
It's really a rewarding thing to do. Obviously, if you're faced with an indoor garden versus an outdoor garden, and you have the space, an outdoor garden is going to make more direct sense because you can, use the sun directly, and if you're in a good situation with good soil, use the earth directly. I think that would be an ideal place for anyone to grow a garden if they could, in my personal opinion. The indoor garden, in my view, should be looked at as somewhat of a supplement. Like you framed correctly, anybody who lives in an urban environment that doesn't have a lawn, maybe they have a homeowners association. I'm aware of some that, if you have plants growing over the fence line, that it's against the rules, things like that. So it can be very restrictive. Indoor gardening is something that has come an extremely long way. Even in the last 10 years that I've been doing these kinds of things, I remember looking at, how much it cost to buy a red pepper 10 years ago, and it was $1-$2, and you can easily find an organic red pepper for $5 in the grocery store these days. So the fact that our food costs are rising so exponentially really puts indoor gardening kind of in a different light, whereas 10 years ago it might have been a hobby, whereas today it can legitimately be a way of growing a lot of many different crops. I mean, some we'll get into that in a little bit, I'm sure, but some crops make more sense than others to do indoors. Maybe that's something that we could touch on as a topic on the show to try to help people think about what would be best to grow and whatnot.
Yeah, let's get into that right now because I'm sure people are interested. What grows best indoors?
Well, it's not so much what grows best. It's more of what's most cost effective is really probably the way to look at it. Obviously it makes sense. You're not going to start a cornfield in your living room. You could, don't get me wrong, you could, but the amount of food you would actually get out of the energy that went in to produce it would be very minimal relative to other crops. Such, peppers are very high producers. Lettuce is something that grows very quickly and that you can harvest as it grows, as are herbs. Tomatoes, you can get really extremely high yields out of tomatoes. And that's really one thing to factor into this conversation is a lot of the times indoor gardening is pegged as just to what, and this is for people that are really knowledgeable about the situation, is pegged as like a way of doing hydroponics. But we really need to illustrate the fact that, you can obviously hand water your plants and soil indoors, and consequently you can also have a hydroponic system outdoor under the sun. So you know, it doesn't really define the way in which you grow, and really even what you grow. It's more of a cost benefit if that's the approach that you're taking. Of course, if you're looking at it from a hobby perspective, that's really irrelevant, and many people do. So wouldn't want to discourage people to think about it on that level either. But it's really, you know, you can really kind of take it as far as you want, and, you know, look at your energy bill per month. And, you know, obviously indoors you're going to need to supplement some sort of lighting relative to what you would just get from normal ambient lighting. And we can, you know, talk technically about that as well. One of the things that we do as with our retail business is, you know, really take people's rooms and the specifications of the room. You know, where does the door, where does it open? How much closet space do you have? What sort of space do you want to dedicate to your garden? And then reverse engineer, actually helping them design a grow room based off of that. Because one of the things that people do look to do indoors is have somewhat of a perpetual situation where you can take a plant from vegetative, from say propagation to vegetative growth, and then into flowering and harvest, and kind of move plants through that mechanism. And you actually, you know, want different characteristics for different stages of growth. So you know, that's something that you can really look into with much detail. And you know, as we've talked about previously, a lot of what you learn in that journey is really, you know, getting started and you know, taking some knocks and figuring out what works and what doesn't. That's really what farming is all about.
What kind of space should someone be looking for if they just want to get started and what is the productivity level per square foot that one could get?
Yeah, that's a good way to ask that. It really, what you want to look for is about at least 20 watts a square foot of light from a light that's deemed a grow light. And let's talk about that for a second, because I think maybe take a step back and think about lighting first, and then that might make more sense what I was saying. You have what's called HID, high-intensity discharge lights, and they encompass things like metal halide and high-pressure sodium. So think street light or the lamp that you would see at a ball field. Very intense light. They cover very large spaces. You can imagine, you know, walking into like a big box store with a 30-foot ceiling. If you had, you know, 40-watt fluorescent tubes on the ceiling, you probably wouldn't be able to see the floor, you know. So this is the kind of light that really penetrates and will cover space. And then you have generally a category. So you have HIDs, and then you have fluorescents. And fluorescents encompass a category that contains different types of lighting, so with different intensities. So to make a connection for people, you know, in the normal old school office building, a lot of lighting is being updated these days, but those thick tubes that you're used to seeing, like shop lights, you know, those 4-foot tubes of 40 watts, those are called T12 lamps. The compact fluorescents people are pretty familiar with, the curly Q type lights, are T8 fluorescents. And then you have an even smaller gauge tube called a T5 fluorescent, and that's the new technology in fluorescence. The T number is a measurement of the diameter of the tube. So the idea is the more pressure, the smaller the tube, the more pressure the gas is under, the more light it emits per watt. Now, lighting can be a fairly technical thing, so, you know, it's not really necessary to understand all of this, but just kind of throw it out there and see what sticks. You have a couple different ways of looking at light. The first thing is lumens, and that's what most people are used to knocking around when they're considering indoor grow lights. Well, lumen is an interesting thing. It actually is a generally irrelevant way to approach efficiency in light. The more lumen output you have, the more light you're getting. But the problem is it's to a human's eye. It's not to a plant's chlorophyll. And there's a big difference there because what the light used by a plant in terms of the photosynthetic reaction to it is called the PAR watts, photosynthetically active radiation. And that at this point is actually a conceptual number. In other words, we don't know all of the exact wavelengths a plant needs to grow. We know a lot of the, you know, I'd say maybe 90% if I had to take a guess at it. But that's really where the future of lighting is going, and that's really what LEDs is, and that's kind of a whole other can of worms. But LEDs allows you to choose the wavelengths, which also means, you know, just as we've done with essential elements in plants and said plants need 17 to grow and they really need much, much more than that, or want much, much more than that, you can do the same thing with lighting. You know, to define a light with specific wavelengths means you know all the wavelengths needed, and round you go. So to get back to the direct condensation, you got the HID lights, you got the fluorescence. You really don't want to grow with anything other than T5 fluorescence. And what's cool is the T5 fluorescence, this is kind of where it gets complicated, actually put out the same amount of lumen as an HID light. The difference is in the intensity of the light, which is a different metric altogether. So what that means in general terms is that if you have a larger room, say like a bedroom or 8x8 room that you're looking to, you know, light with primary light, you really don't want to think about fluorescence, because the fluorescent fixture, even though you're getting the same amount of light coming out, it's not as intense. So it dissipates very quickly, meaning the further you get away from the light, the faster the light dissipates. And with the fluorescent, because the intensity is not high, you really lose a whole lot of light output at a foot away from the fixture. So you really don't want to grow outside of the fixture size itself. And these fluorescents will come in 4-foot lengths. So you can imagine with an HID light, you can raise it up. You really can't get the plant within 2 feet of the fixture. It'll actually physically burn the plant. So you can raise this light up and actually cover space and penetrate larger areas. And what's cool is you can even put them on light movers that actually will cover even larger spaces and move the light back and forth for you. So really, to kind of round all that out, the estimation is, you know, do I have a large space versus a smaller space? And if you're going to get started, a fluorescent's fine to use. But you really kind of have to keep those factors in mind when you're evaluating what light to choose for an indoor garden.
How does the efficiency compare between the HID and the fluorescence and the resultant electricity cost?
Well, in terms of the wattage, that's really the way to gauge that. A watt's a watt, whether it comes from a hairdryer or from a lighting fixture. So, you know, to give you kind of a way to square that, a 400-watt light, somewhere around, and that's going to cover as a primary square footage, say no more than about a 4x4 area. Anytime, if you took 400 watts and 4x4 is 16 square feet, and you divide 400 by 16, you're right at 25 watts a square foot. So that's right in range with where you want to be. That's about a little under $10 on your power bill a month, run 14 hours a day. So to get the same amount of light coming out in terms of the lumen output, and arguably with the fluorescence, maybe even a higher par watts, meaning what the plant can actually use from it, it takes about 432 watts of that same, of a T5 fixture to get the same amount of output as the 400. Now, because there's not an even baseline to judge a light on in regards to plant performance, it's kind of impossible to answer that question directly. But the fluorescents are going to be a little less efficient, a little less. I mean, you're splitting hairs almost with 30 watts a month, or 30 watts in the fixture over a month period, I should say. But in the end, it's really about the functionality of it. You know, one of the benefits that people get out of the fluorescents is that they tend to be able to keep the fixtures closer to the plant, like we were discussing a minute ago. You really lose light if you don't. So people tend to end up, and this is the feedback that we get from a lot of our customers, they tend to use it more efficiently because they're paying more attention to where the fixture is. Whereas if you just raise the light up four feet off of a canopy, you know, you really want to keep it 2 feet with an HID. But the higher you raise it, the more light you lose. So you kind of have to factor that in. And one of the indirect results is people use fluorescence more effectively for that reason. So the electricity cost is not so much the way to think about it. It's more about the type of garden and the setup, the framework of the garden that you're really thinking about in regards to what light to choose.
Well, what about natural light?
Mm-hmm.
Putting your plants, you know, on a table in a really sunny location, a place that gets, you know, sun a lot of the day. How well can that work?
Well, it can work as a supplement, great. But very rarely, and even in a south facing window, you know, it's very hard to get more than 6 hours of direct light. And you're filtering it with windows and in different ways that maybe you don't know. So I'd never discourage people from using that, because in the end, you want to use the sun if you can. I mean, the point here is not to try to reinvent farming and do it all indoors. The point is to give us options to get food that we know where it comes from. And then, you know, also to gain experience in doing these things. I've seen many a time where people start in an indoor garden, they kind of get a bug for doing it, and it parlays into taking their whole yard over. So it's funny how, you know, the different ways you can enter into this can kind of catch you. So in the end, you want to use supplemental light if you can. It's just a question of whether you can get at least, I'd say, 8 hours of direct light a day. If you're not, you really can't drive production in a flowering plant such as a tomato or a pepper. You're just not going to get what you want out of it. You're going to end up with real leggy plants, things like that, plants stretching for the sun. So short answer is, you know, do it if you can, but use it as a supplement. I mean, to give you an idea, in climates, you know, like up in Canada where they have a shorter day length, shorter growing seasons, the government actually subsidizes artificial lighting for agriculture. And then that's one of the reasons why so many of the tomatoes found in the U.S. market have been from Canada over the years. You're seeing a lot of them from Mexico now. But, you know, the Canadian government knows they can't compete with the growing seasons we have and actually uses that as supplemental lighting. So what they'll do is, you know, say 4 or 5 o'clock when it starts to get dark, they'll turn the lights on at that time. And that'd also be something for people to think about with greenhouses. So a lot of the times these same lights that we're talking about, primarily HID lights in greenhouses and things of that nature, but they're used as supplements to the natural sun. So you just kind of have to make sense of your own personal situation.
Does the moisture factor of a greenhouse come into play when using an electrical fixture such as the HID? Are there special lights for greenhouses?
There are some that are marketed that way. Most of the time, though, it's the footprint and the reflector that's marketed. So it's not to block the sun. Say if you had it directly overhead of the growing plants. In terms of the concerns for electrical output with, you know, moisture, things of that nature, that's pretty much been taken care of in the construction of the fixture itself. You're going to get, most of the times when you buy a ballast that's deemed for gardening, you're going to get a 5-year warranty on that product. And I've seen ballasts last for 10 years. A lot of that is heat dependent. So the heat in grow rooms and not ventilating your grow room correctly, which is something that we should probably also touch on, kills ballast more so than any kind of moisture issue. Most of this stuff is UL listed, has been tested in almost any situation, and you shouldn't really have a concern towards that in operation.
Great. We'll get right to that after we take a break for a short message from our sponsors. You're listening to Food Integrity Now. We'll be right back.
This is Carol again, and I just wanted to talk to you about one of our new sponsors, Hole in the Wall Herb and Vitamin Shop up in Woodland Park. The owners, Mark and Nancy Duvall, are not only close personal friends, but they're also my nutritional gurus. They are now selling, teaching, and doing Acira bioenergetic testing on their clients. I had this done, and I found out all my food allergies, emotional stressors, environmental sensitivities, hormonal balance, and I received a customized homeopathic remedy. Please call them for more information at 1-800-437-3240. Linda Masterson, Soul Purpose Astrologer, works with astrological tools and with guides in the non-physical to assist ones in knowing their soul purpose. Important in this process is identification of significant blockages. In each session, tools are provided for working with self to clear resistance and free talents, skills, and abilities to fuller expression. The goal is to take responsibility for and to accelerate the healing process. Phone sessions are offered by Linda. Please visit Linda at lindamasterson.com or call 808-651-0307. Again, that's 808-651-0307.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. We're talking with Evan Folds about indoor gardening. And before the break, Carol, you had a question?
I do have a question. We touched on something I think that is a pretty important question, is about ventilation. How do you handle that with growing an indoor garden? I know, you know, having a greenhouse, you got to have, you know, allow for, you know, bees and such, and have some sort of ventilation. So how do you suggest that people do that in their indoor gardens?
Yeah, well, it absolutely is important. It's a little different, but because we're not used to thinking about these kinds of things, but it's really not that complicated. It's really about positive and negative pressure in the end. So the way to think about it simply is, you know, like a bathroom fan. When you turn that fan on, it's pulling air out of the room, and you can't make a vacuum in a home, even if you really tried. Outside of a lab, it's almost impossible to create a vacuum. So the idea is, when you remove air from a room, it creates negative pressure, and it pulls air into the room under the door or through cracks in the wall or wherever it's coming from. The reverse of that is, if you were pushing air into the room and air had to leave the room, because atmospheric pressure is only going to allow so much air to be in that room by volume. So the preferred way of doing it is to pull it, to remove air from the room with a vent, with an exhaust fan, and then let it be passive on the intake. Now, here's a way to think about that. Say you have a room with a window in it and a crack under the door. Well, if you open the window and put a towel under the door and your exhaust fan comes on, the air that comes into the room is going to be coming from outside. If you close the window and take the towel out from under the door, the air, when the fan comes on, exhaust fan comes on, is going to be pulling it under the door. So you can actually encourage where your air intake comes from, depending on where you want it to. Now, if it's 100 degrees outside, obviously you don't want it to be coming from outside. If it's, you know, and if it's cooler, you can actually use that temperature, say from a crawl space or something like that. So you can be conscious of where you want your air to come from. But in the end, that it does two things when you ventilate that air. One is, when you remove, you know, make the connection that plants use carbon dioxide for photosynthesis to produce food for themselves. So, you know, CO2 is about 400 parts per million in the air. Plants can actually use up to 1,600 parts per million in the air, and you can actually help us watch a plant grow, supplementing CO2 into a grow room. But not to get too far ahead of ourselves, so you got that 400 parts per million million in the air. The plants are using that over time. So you can see, if you don't have some sort of air exchange, that at some point the CO2 is going to become the limiting factor, and the plant's not going to be able to grow the way it would like to. So one thing that it does when you remove air from the room is it removes stale air, and then the air that follows it in from under the door, say, is fresh air, and you're resupplying that CO2 over time. So it's air exchange on one level, and then it's also the way that you control heat. So the way to think about it is, if you've got that grow light, which is going to produce an element of heat, and many people actually exhaust that hot air into other areas of their homes to actually heat their homes in the winter. That's the same way of maybe using the crawl space air to cool it, kind of thing. But the idea is, if you're removing 90 degree air from your room, say, and you've got central air and your air conditioning is working in your house, and you're bringing in 70 degree air, well, it's only a matter of how much air you need to move to keep it the temperature that you want. So this is how you gauge out how big a fan should be. They're rated in cubic feet per minute, CFM it's called. So if you've got, you know, 1,000 cubic feet, length times width times height, and you've got a 500 CFM fan, well, it's going to take 2 minutes for that room to completely flush and refresh the entire room of air. And, you know, a commercial greenhouse might shoot for a minute on its air exchange, but indoors, as long as you're anywhere near 5 minutes, you're fine. So the idea is, it can, you know, it exchanges the air on one hand, and then it also controls your heat. And you could put that fan on a thermostat and put it on 79 degrees, and as soon as the temperature in the room hit 79 degrees, the fan would come on, it'd be pulling the hot air out, and the cooler air would be coming in, and that's how you maintain your temperature.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's literally creating an environment. You know, that's kind of what it's all about, and that's a lot of the bug that people get indoors, is you can really tweak it out and kind of, you know, create a perpetual spring and no cloudy days, and really do some amazing things with plants in ideal conditions.
Well, what about pollination? I mean, is that something that you know, that you need to be concerned about with growing indoors?
On balance, no, not really. Most certified organic seeds that we sell are open pollinated, meaning they do not need to be cross pollinated with a male and a female. There are exceptions to that, but generally, you know, a lot of plants have been bred to that state. Now, that's not to say that bees aren't helping, but it does mean that, you know, you can get away with shaking your plant. And, you know, if good ventilation, a leaf flutter, you know, because it's one thing to have an exhaust fan and remove air and move the air in the whole room around, but it's also advisable to have a circulation fan, something that's actually going to mix the air within the room. Because a lot of the times when you have your exhaust fan on, you don't need to have it on the whole time the light's on. So, you know, it's not going to be constantly moving the air. CO2 is heavier than air, and you can actually move it around with the fan. So as long as you're doing those things, you really shouldn't have to get into, you know, getting a Q-tip and pollinating it yourself, even though, you know, arguably it wouldn't hurt.
From a biodynamic standpoint and from an energy standpoint, what is the difference between light coming from artificial light and that coming from the sun on the plant?
Well, the simple answer there is the sun is the ideal. You know, that's what all indoor lighting technology is trying to replicate. And the only way to really do that with any sort of efficient, well, let's put it this way. Over the years, it's become unbelievably more efficient to do that. And there's still technologies, especially with LEDs, that show great promise for the future. But again, outside of that direct knowledge of all the wavelengths a plant needs, LEDs have really at this point shown to be just a supplement. So you could run your HID light for 15 minutes of the hour and the LEDs the rest and accomplish all the light. So the way to think about this is HID lights, they encompass all the wavelengths. The trick is getting them in the ratio that's ideal for the plant, which takes a ton of trial and error and millions of dollars. And, you know, the fact that the indoor gardening industry is only as big as it is relative to the general lighting industry, it hasn't been really a focus over time, but it's becoming more and more of a focus as, you know, people wake up to the fact that, you know, we need more food security and know where our food's coming from, and so many more people are doing this. So, you know, from a biodynamic perspective, you grow in the earth under the sun. I think the way to look at indoor gardening is that it's a whole heck of a lot better than the food that you're, you know, buying conventionally from a grocery store. So it's more about, you know, finding ways to be more efficient. You know, there's trade-offs with indoor gardening. Let's, you know, take a hydroponic setup. You know, you can save a 20th of the water. In hydroponics, you can grow 10 times the amount of produce per area, things like that. But, you know, you're also using indoor electricity. So there's a trade-off there. So you kind of have to take all of that with a grain of salt and really come down to where your comfort level is. But I would say that now versus 10 years ago, it is cost effective to grow your plants indoors. You just have to be very selective about how you do it, and, you know, make sure that you've designed it to the utmost of efficiency and really aren't wasting things, you know, running a fan where you don't need to and things of that nature. So, you know, it's always ideal to be in the earth under the sun.
With hydroponics, you can grow 10 times the amount of produce per square foot.
Yeah, and that I'd say that's a conservative average, to be honest with you. I've seen estimates of 30 tons per acre of tomatoes to 300 tons, and with some crops, it's much more than that. With some, it's less, you know. But I've even heard references of not just one outfit, but several different outfits being funded to grow hops indoors. One of the repercussions of all the microbrews and the beer world out there is that all the hops are getting bought up left and right, and there's the specialty market is putting so much strain on the normal source for them that people are actually seeing it cost-effective to grow them in different value-added ways. So, you know, the future, who knows what the future holds in that regard, but yeah, hydroponics is absolutely a way of enhancing yields on those levels. The one disconnect there is that, you know, I think we've beat up Miracle-Gro a little bit last week. You know, Miracle, we talk about 17 right. elements the plant has to have to grow, and Miracle-Gro has 7 of them, right? Well, a hydroponics nutrient is generally going to have 17, and that's it. So, you know, while that's better than Miracle-Gro, it's still not ideal in that you're not providing all of the elements for the plant to choose from. That's one of the rationales of the Earth Tonic product that we create. It's ocean water with the Himalayan crystal salt, and you're getting over 90 elements in a plant available form. So we actually advise people to use the Earth Tonic with any base hydroponic nutrient to accomplish that full spectrum of minerals. Because, you know, the analogy is with people, we can eat fast food for every meal, you know, but we make movies out of what happens to us, you know, and in the end, it doesn't provide us the level of nutrition. Even though it's accomplishing the immediate short-term caloric need of food intake, it's not nourishing us in that way that really drives the health that we all appreciate and look for. And it's the same with plants. You can grow a plant with 17 elements, but in the end, if you're not providing the total balanced offering to the plant, it can't do all of the things it's capable of doing. You know, plants can make their own antifreezes. They can make their own antibiotics. They can do all of these amazing things that we restrict them from doing by just growing with them with what they have to have. So, you know, that's one of the innate limitations of hydroponics if you're not focused on the broader picture of trying to grow plants with nutrient density.
Oh, you got my interest piqued. I homebrew my own beer, and I know that there was that hop shortage a couple of years ago, and I've been thinking about growing my own hops, and I didn't consider that it would be possible to grow those hydroponically.
I'd really like to see some of these operations doing it, because it's hard for me to imagine it too. But it's gotten to such a point with the yields, the way that they are, that you know, there's a lot of money being put towards that for sure. I actually had a conversation the other day. It's kind of a cool idea. What if you could actually take a beer company and brew it locally everywhere and actually grow all of the ingredients where the beer is, you know, brand it similarly in all these different places, but actually have the materials used to create it within 50 miles of where it's sold. That would be a pretty neat business model.
I like that idea. So yeah. What is it about hydroponics that makes it so much more productive?
Well, it's actually... It's really the fact that you're providing a plant the concentration of what it wants and striving for a balance that the plant wants in a way that it doesn't have to grow roots. So it can kind of get to be somewhat of a convoluted conversation, because on one hand, you know, like in a lawn, you want the plant to grow roots, to establish the ability to attract moisture in a drought, to outcompete weeds and things of that nature. So if you pump it full of fertilizer, it's actually going to grow its foliage faster and grow at the expense of itself. It's going to grow to be obese in a sense. And it, you know, I don't want to be crude about it, but in the same sense, that's kind of what hydroponics is. It's really creating I would say it's a beneficial obesity, for lack of a better way of framing it. Because with knowledge of what you're missing with water and elements, you can reverse engineer that. You can add things into your system, such as compost teas. You can, you know, enzymes, amino acids. There's a plethora of products out there that allow you to deal with the plant in a hydroponic capacity and have the control of it that you would not attain in a soil-based environment. So a lot of it is that. It's simply that you're increasing the yields relative to the rate of growth in soil, because you're providing more of what a plant wants in that environment. Somewhat the same idea as what we referenced earlier with the CO2 in the air. You know, a plant can use 1,600 parts per million in the air, and it can grow unbelievably faster relative to 400 parts per million, but it only gets 400 from the air. So it's somewhat enhancing the natural proclivity of the environment to get that benefit, which can be a detriment, as I've tried to describe here, depending on what your perspective is and what you're allowing the plant to access within that controlled environment that you've created.
So it could be – so are you saying that you could grow plants that are imbalanced from an energetic standpoint?
Yeah, but the better way to look at it, in my view, is that growing plants hydroponically without – the impulse of pesticides and genetic modification and all of these things that have done to the majority of the food in a supermarket, that what you would grow hydroponically is so much better relative to what we're getting already that it mitigates that concern. You know, I would say grow hydroponics and enhance your yields and get food that way every single time relative to just buying a conventional piece of produce that's honestly, you know, we're beating up Miracle-Gro with having seven elements. You know, 95% of farmers in this country use three or four elements. And, I mean, it's just atrocious what we've come to and you know, this race to the bottom line and food. It's really, we've really lost the reason that we're doing it for in the first place. And that's somewhat alleviated by the technology of hydroponics because you can control this environment. And honestly, the water savings alone is enough to really make sense of it on many levels. If you look in how we use water in places like California, I mean, I think 70% of the water in California is actually used for agriculture. 70% of that water is actually used to grow alfalfa for cows. So, you know, it's kind of mind-numbing to think about a statistic like that. I mean, and that really is born of you know, our eating habits, and it's wildly out of control. So there's so many instances of waste in our food systems that it's hard to really pick up on something like hydroponics and it not being ideal and really take that to the bank as a large concern.
Would you recommend that a beginner indoor grower who's ambitious and wants to grow the most start out with hydroponics?
I would definitely encourage people to try it. You know, it's interesting to me. You can't really get a feel for who's going to gravitate to what until you've kind of tried a little bit of both. I mean, we have people that come in and you know, they've been soil gardeners forever and you know, they try a little 5-gallon bucket hydroponic system and you know, they get hooked on it. They love it and they end up with like, you know, 10 5-gallon buckets and then they got to graduate up to a larger system that has, you know, one central reservoir because it takes so much time to individually monitor each of the 10 buckets. And you know, some people try a 5-gallon bucket and they say, oh, that's not for me, I'll go back to soil. So you know, I definitely encourage people to try it. If you want the highest yield, hydroponics will deliver that without a doubt. I would just, you know, there's a way to get the best of both worlds, and that's, you know, one of the easiest ways to do that is with compost tea, because you're really adding a lot of the micronutrients from the organic inputs that you're using that you're not getting from a hydroponic nutrient. And more importantly, in a form that the plant expects. You know, microbes make plant food. So if you can really allow plants this access to that and also the help of the microorganisms, that's a big, big plus. You know, and on top of that, hydroponics, I imagine some people have in their minds that, you know, it's just plant roots and water, and that can be true. That's true hydroponics. It's called a water culture system, where you just have roots growing down into a reservoir, and you have bubbles occurring, and the aeration's happening, just like fish in an aquarium. You have to aerate it for the fish to breathe. You do the same thing for the roots. But you can also have media-based hydroponic systems, where you actually have trays and then containers in that tray that you can either flood and drain the entire tray, or you can set up a drip system that actually drips each individual container. And honestly, you could replace that soilless media, and what I mean by that is something like ProMix or MetroMix or Core Fiber or something that does that lacks nutrition, is really just used for stability and water retention. So that's still a hydroponic scenario. It's without soil. So depending on how you set up your system to grow, you can do it with soil as well.
Walk us through that introductory 5-gallon system. What is involved with that in setting it up?
Sure. It's very, very easy. I mean, you could buy the components to set up a hydroponic system at a local gardening store for, you know, say something like $60. A 5-gallon bucket, say you have the lid to a 5-gallon bucket, and you just, what's called a net pot, and it could be a silo cup with some holes in it that allow the roots to grow through it. It doesn't have to be anything complicated.
What's a silo cup?
Just like a drinking cup, you know, like
okay. Oh, gotcha.
Just, yeah, you know, just kind of anything that will allow the roots to grow through it. Normally when you're growing in soil, you're thinking about containing the roots and the moisture for that matter. You have holes in the bottom, of course, but you're not thinking about the roots growing through the container itself. In this system, you'd actually, you know, cut a little hole in the lid of the 5-gallon bucket that would support the cup, that would hold the lip of the cup, in other words, so it didn't fall all the way through into the container. The roots would be allowed to grow through the holes in the cup into the 5-gallon bucket itself. You'd fill the 5-gallon bucket up, say, to the bottom of the cup that you're using to hold the plants in place, and then if you're familiar with an aquarium, you're directly familiar with what you need for a hydro system. You basically just need a small air pump. You can find one of those for $9-$10 at a garden center, some tubing, and then that would be attached to what's called an air stone or an air diffuser. And basically all that does is break the bubbles up at the end of the tube when it's being pushed through the tubing by the air pump. And the reason you do that is that the smaller the bubble, the more surface area there is exposed in the solution, the more dissolved oxygen you can accomplish in that solution. So once you have the air pump running through the air tubing, hitting the stone in your solution, bubbling up the water, that's really your hydroponic system. It's as simple as that. And then to finish it off, all you would need is a complete nutrient, something that did provide all nutrients, essential nutrients, in a relatively balanced form. And then you would correct the pH of that solution after you'd added your nutrient to about 5.8 to 6.5, somewhere in there, just about what you would want in soil. And, you know, from there, you basically just change your reservoir once every 2 weeks, and that's all there really is to it.
I'm wondering about the plastic used. I know that there's food-grade and non-food-grade plastics, so I assume you'd want a food-grade plastic bucket. And what about the silo cup? Would that those are single-use cups. Would that degrade over time?
It would. I mentioned that not as an ideal, just more as to kind of paint a picture in people's minds. I mean, there's what's called net pots in the hydroponic world, and they're used specifically to in applications such as that. So, yeah, I mean, that would be something to keep in mind. I suppose there's a concern on some level with any sort of plastic. Of course, you could make a hydroponic system out of just about anything that would hold water in the end. But it's interesting to note that back in the 70s, when plastics first came about, you know, we all remember the movie The Graduate, you know, where they started talking at the end, the future was plastics. You know, that really changed a lot of things. Before that, hydroponics was really only used by the government in the wars over in Iwo Jima and the southeast. You know, during the wars, they set them up in the 50s and the 60s coming through there to feed a lot of the soldiers, and they would use concrete gullies. And there was a high cost on doing that, obviously, and they learned a lot with the different materials they used from leaching and, you know, losing a lot of plants to figure out what would work and what wouldn't. And what when plastics came around, it was a ready alternative for people to make a cheap method of containing that, and that's really kind of what the industry is built on. So, you know, if you do have concerns about that, definitely seek them out and certainly use food grade containers.
So in someone going out there and saying perhaps doing a slightly upgraded version of the 5 gallon bucket, and perhaps buying a net bag or perusing other hydroponics availabilities, I'm sure that there's a range of what's available, and some people don't really care what kind of plastic their hydro equipment is made out of. What should someone look for
in terms of the plastic that's used?
Yeah.
I can't speak to the technicalities of
okay,
you know, what exact plastics they can use. I can speak to the fact that, you know, there are, in my mind and in my surface research of what plastics you use, you basically look to the fact of if it's affecting the plant or not. And, you know, unfortunately, with the way the economy is going and the way things are done these days, a lot of the equipment that is sold in the hydroponics industry will come from China. And we probably heard the news and other facets of society on, you know, how they don't do things the way that we might want them to do a lot of the times. And there's been instances where some tubing has been made incorrectly, and it actually harmed plants. So obviously, if you're having that kind of issue, you don't want to be messing with it. But generally, you know, these things are looked at beforehand, and, you know, you don't want any kind of the BPA off-gassing going on, that kind of thing. But you can, you know, you can look at the little triangle on the below your plastic, on the bottom of your plastic, and then there's like a 1 to 5. I think there's actually a 7 number now. And the higher the number, the more reliable the plastic is in regards to that off-gassing. So I guess that would be one thing I could offer in vetting that.
Okay. Because I would think that, you know, some of these chemicals that could be released in the water, could they be up into the plant and not affect the plant's health, and then end up in the produce that the plant produces?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's always possible. You know, I mean, the resiliency of plants can't be underestimated. you know, same with the human body. I saw a study the other day about, you know, umbilical cords being isolated and finding, you know, multiple forms of pesticides and toxins, and, you know, the BPA and from plastics is known to mimic estrogen and create havoc in the body. You know, males, they produce estrogen, they produce more testosterone, and that's one of the things that's been implicated, and one of the dangers of these plastics is really that creating haywire in these hormonal systems in the body. So, you know, that would probably be a question for an expert greater than I on that.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We're going to take another commercial break, and we will be right back. You're listening to Food Integrity Now with Evan Foltz.
Hello again, it's Carol. I'm one of the hosts of Food Integrity Now and a certified life coach, and I'd like to share with you an amazing adventure. I take groups on spiritual journeys to swim with the dolphins in the wild. If you'd like more information, please go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or email me at carol@coachwithcarol.com. Mahalo.
Experiencing anxiety, anger, depression, or low self-esteem? Do you beat yourself up or sabotage what you truly want to achieve? Hi, this is Jeannie Smith, and at Open Heart Healing, I combine counseling, gestalt therapy, and Tai Chi energy work to assist those who truly desire to bring quality and joy back into their lives. My office is located on South Perry Street here in Castle Rock. Call me for a free consultation at 303-660-6373. Again, that's 303-660-6373, or visit me at openhearthealing.com.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. For our final segment with Evan Foltz on this part of our growing series on indoor gardening, and I feel like I've learned a lot, and I think I want to start getting into a little hydroponics and see what's up with that. What about you, Carol?
Yeah, I know. I was thinking the same thing. I thought, I don't know, maybe I need to rethink this greenhouse thing and go hydroponics.
Man, with tennis,
well, you could do hydroponics in the greenhouse.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
maybe I'll
do
those
increased yields. That's really awesome.
Wow.
I've actually been thinking about putting in a light in my greenhouse to supplement the light when the light starts getting short here, especially because I live on the northern slope of a mountain. And kind of lose the sunlight a little bit earlier than if I lived anywhere else, like on a south-facing slope or on the plains. So definitely got some ideas going on. So Evan, for getting back on topic for indoor gardening, is there anything else that you feel that people should know in order to complete this session that we've had talking about indoor gardening?
Well, I think you hit the notes of how to think about what light you want, and you know, also thinking about the air circulation. You know, those things are pretty much the high notes of what to think about in terms of the workings of a grow room. From there, it's experiment. You know, one thing that can really help the design aspect of it, because it, you know, if you're not a do-it-yourselfer and you know, into constructing and knocking holes in the walls and these kinds of things, there's some great grow tents out there, for lack of a better word. You can find them online all over the place now, and they, you know, for about $250, you can buy a 4x4 tent that basically literally it zips up it's been reinforced for you. And has the holes already in it with zip ties that, you know, allow you to encourage it from one place and not the other. And it's really and even been thought about in regards to using CO2 in these environments. So you can get one of these tents, set it up in 20, 30 minutes in a spare room and create that ideal environment. One of the things that's really, I guess, would be important to mention is, if you know, say you have a fairly large bedroom, a spare bedroom, and you're wanting to garden in it, and you don't want to kind of deck the whole thing out from the get-go. Well, it's important to keep in mind that if you just put your setup, say, in the corner of an open room, well, if you're not reflecting light, you know, imagine literally it was in the corner. So two sides were up against the wall and the other two were open to the room itself. Well, if your light is positioned in the corner and two of the sides have open or open to the room and you can make a shadow with that light that's coming out, well, you're wasting light. You know, so it's really important to reflect the light back to the garden so as to utilize all of it, especially in the, you know, the idea of efficiency that we're discussing throughout these segments. So, you know, this tent is just a ready-made way of encapsulating that entire growing system. And it's not only that, it's also that, you know, if you have a 4x4 space in the corner of a larger room, well, you're going to have to buy a ventilation fan that's responsible for the total cubic footage of the room. So rather than ventilating the whole room and only using a fourth of it, these grow tents actually give you an ability to isolate the garden and have a smaller fan running, potentially a smaller light relative to doing it otherwise, and really make a lot more efficiency out of the situation. And the cool thing with that is that you can also kind of upgrade as you go. You can, you know, we mentioned earlier in the show where you might want to think about a propagation area and then a vegetative area and then a flowering area. You know, indoors, you know, what that would mean light-wise is, you know, vegetative light is more of a metal halide, to speak to the, or a blue-oriented light. High-pressure sodium is more of a flowering light or a red-oriented light in, say, the fluorescent realm of things. And the reason for that is, you know, in the end, you can't really make a plant do something it's not capable of. So a plant's a plant, and it's really important to view an indoor garden from a plant's perspective. So one of the ways that you can really get maximum efficiency is by feeding it the type of light that it would want at the stage of growth that it's in. And this is the idea of blue light in the beginning, red light in the end is born of the ideas, you know, say outdoors in April, you have an 18-hour day and you have a bright blue sun straight overhead. Where in the fall, you know, especially, you know, on the equator, obviously you're getting what you get year-round, but in the higher latitudes, in the fall, you're getting a shorter day period. We just passed the equinox, so our days are getting shorter. And then you're getting more of a red light because the sun is lower in the atmosphere relatively, and it's traveling through more of it, which skews it more to a red spectrum. So plants have evolved to expect different day lengths, different photo periods, and then also different frequencies of light at different stages of growth. So you can kind of take that and run with it and see how far down the rabbit hole you can go and really setting up a garden in the most ideal of scenarios. And that's what I meant earlier about literally watching a plant grow. You can seriously, I mean, that you can come back from, you know, 10 minutes later and the plant's grown if it's really in an ideal spot.
That's so cool. Do you think creating that artificial cycle, so say that you were putting the plant through that vegetative spring into an artificial fall in the middle of winter, do you think that would affect the plant in a negative manner as opposed to having it go with the natural cycles of nature?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. My gut says probably. I'd probably frame it not so much as a negative as maybe not as much of a positive, because you're still knowing where that food's coming from. You're still, you know, it's not like if you use a blue light, the plant's not going to produce a flower. It's a better best analogy. So, but you know what? I think there is some truth in what you were driving at there, because there's so many impulses that plants, or I should say, nature is attuned to that we don't experience. They're unobservable, you know, and that's, you know, to round out, you know, kind of bring the biodynamic impulse into it, that's really what biodynamics is. I mean, you know, who in their right mind in modern society would tell you that, you know, Saturn has an effect on plant growth, you know? I mean, and that's just not something that we're used to addressing collectively, and it's comes off as crazy to some people. But the reality is these things have, you know, been investigated to such an extent and proven in very tangible quantitative ways. Same with the moon. I mean, most people are hip to the fact that the Farmer's Almanac still contains plant by the, sow by the moon, you know, meaning plant your seeds at the full moon as opposed to a new moon or a waxing moon versus a waning moon. It's such a hard thing to break through in terms of how we teach ourselves in school materialistically, because, you know, the most that people can really muster to think about that concept is the extra gravity coming from the moon. You know, that's why it's closer, so it pulls the plant up more. You know, that's kind of the knee-jerk response to that. But if it was really gravity, the plant would be growing down. You know, so there's just a disconnect between what we're willing to accept and then what the reality is from a natural perspective. I could tell the same story about people that use acupuncture. You know, my dad, he gets a great benefit out of it, but rarely does he address the energetic aspects of why it's working, you know. And I could say the same thing about agriculture. So from that perspective, I would imagine that there is some sort of rhythm that the plant could keep up to. And one of the things that we've got in line for the future is really looking at how we can grid out grow rooms and bring back some of these natural energies, kind of like feng shui for the grow room in a sense, because, you know, we have all of these abilities to figure things out as humans, and we make these grow rooms and we have all the wavelengths and all the water and the nutrients and everything physically right, but we don't think about the EMF coming from the ballasts and the unnatural energies that are created by electricity. And that's not to say they're necessarily harmful directly, although, you know, they might not help some people, but in the end, it's really, you know, we don't really know what effect it has on it, and it's very easy to understand when in terms of representing a discussion that there's energies from an outdoor perspective that actually encourage plants to grow. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of the sonic bloom, but it's a technology where this guy Dan Carlson basically figured out these specific frequencies that would affect plants positively, and it actually opened the stomata on their leaves. And he designed it in conjunction with this foliar spray, which took him like 15 years to develop with the frequencies, because plants with the open stomata would take up different balances of nutrients in different ways relative to what they normally did. So he had to make this foliar spray with it and jive it. And when he did, he set all these world records for growing plants. And, you know, who'd have thought that the noises would affect plants, you know, frequencies of noise, which would affect plants in these ways. But, you know, think about the birds chirping at you know, the same time at the different times of year, you know, like the mating calls versus, you know, the feeding calls, and all these things happen in a very cyclical and chaotic way in nature. And it's really hard to get a grasp of how it all affects the living system. So, you know, you can't ever lose that impulse, even when you're gardening indoors. It's a very important thing to think about when you're farming or gardening.
Yeah, no kidding. My friend Yul Culbertson, who we've had on the show a couple times, he uses some sonic devices. He has one that mm-hmm. kind of sounds like a frog, and he grows the most amazing produce. And he only has 12 acres, but he just feeds so many people with that. And I think that is a really fascinating area. Of these developing technologies that work with the energies of the plants.
Yeah, there's a long way to go with that. You know, I see that as a lot of the future. There's a lot of companies that are becoming more mainstream now that are addressing these things, and I'm aware of many technologies that are implementing funding and about to be brought to market that deal with frequencies. And you know, everything has a vibration in the end, living things do. And, you know, there's actually a researcher in France that isolated different amino acids, and they all had different frequencies, and he replicated that frequency, and the resonance of the frequency actually encouraged that amino acid to grow more in the plant. So you can just kind of take that little nugget and apply it to, you know, what if you could apply frequencies to plants to get them to do the things that we want them to do? And that's a maybe a whole other show in and of itself right there.
Yeah, that would be a great show. We'd love to do that. We're almost up at our time for the hour, but I think we're going to go over a little bit and make sure we finish up. You got a little extra time, Evan?
Sure.
Yeah, because I realize that we we missed a big section that I think is important to recognize, and that is the nutrients that go into the hydroponics system, and can you do that organically?
Well, it's a good question. Yes is the short answer. Within the last 2 or 3 years, has been a couple of nutrients that have come out. One nutrient line called Nature's Nectar and another one called Pura Vida by a company called Technoflora that have gotten organic certification for nutrients that can be used in hydroponics, certified organic. Now, I don't know that the price point on those is going to allow it to be done on a bulk scale yet. And I'm aware that the Pura Vida technology, it was actually almost an accident. And there was some fungi that they discovered that when coupled with a specific food source, cycled nitrogen at 6%. And that conventionally was the limitation on organic hydroponic nutrients, is that you couldn't attain an NPK high enough, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, relative to drive production. Because, you know, when you're dealing with water, and forget the growing media, they would have no nutrition either. You're really responsible for all of the nutrition. And that was kind of the disconnect of not having nutrients that would be certified organic. Now, you also have to couple the fact in of – and I can't speak to it on these specific nutrients, but you know, the organic standards have been watered down relative to what their original intention was. So how much of that plays into that, I'm not sure. But one interesting difference in how you use these nutrients is when we were discussing the simple hydro system earlier, where you add your nutrient and you pH balance that solution, and then you're going to switch your aerate the water, and you're going to switch your reservoir every 2 weeks. Well, it's counterintuitive relative to how you would use organic nutrients. You don't aerate the water, you don't pH balance it, and you're going to need to switch your reservoir about once a week. And the reasons for that is that the pH actually disrupts it encourages the availability of the artificial nutrients, but it actually disrupts the availability of organic nutrients. As far as the aeration aspect, I don't have an adequate explanation of that, other than that's what we suggest from the manufacturers of those products. So it is somewhat of a different way of working with them, but you can attain organic growth. And of course, just to plant the seed, you know, the most organic of all, I would say, is an aquaponics system. And we actually have a working aquaponics system in our retail store. It's a lot easier than people might think, and that's just using fish waste to feed plants, with, you know, culturing bacteria to turn the ammonia into a nitrate. And so that's also a technology of the future as well.
So do you actually have fish living in a fish tank, and that's what gets pumped through the hydro system?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it takes a minute it can take anywhere from a month to 3 months to get your – it's kind of like live rock in a saltwater aquarium, if anybody's familiar with that. But it takes some time to develop the microbiological community to be able to cycle the amount of waste. And there's a loose equation in regards to how many gallons of water you have with how much growing area and how many fish. But if you're within that general range and you've got the fish producing ammonia and the bacteria that inhabit the growing media that you're using actually take that ammonia and cycle it into a nitrate that the plant can use. And then, you know, there's this guy who lives in our town that's been doing it for about 3 or 4 years now, and he started with just a hobby, and now he's got, I don't even know how many, it must be 1,000 square feet of growing bed. It's a really, really impressive setup. He had fruiting tomatoes in January this year in this little lean-to on the side of his house, and he's got catfish and bluegill and all these large fish running through his system, and he literally maintains it maybe once a month. It literally is a living system, and he's got composting worms running through his grow bed media. He buries bananas for the potassium. It's just really a fascinating setup, because it once you get it to that stability and it's taking cycling itself and taking care of itself in the right way, you don't need to maintain it. You don't need to add anything to the system. And I think that's really the germ of all of this, is how do you set it up to take care of itself? That's what a living system really is. So if you can get to that level of things, that's pretty exciting. And, you know, there's now systems on the market where you can do it on a smaller scale, but on a smaller scale, you're probably not going to be able to attain the fish volume or weight in the fish that would really allow you to eat the fish. It would more be more of just a food source for the plants more than anything. I mean, in the system that we have, you know, we've got maybe a 20-gallon Rubbermaid size grow container with a growing media in it and a fish tank about, I'd say, maybe 4 feet long, 2 feet wide. I don't know exactly know how many gallons it is, but in something about that size, about the size of a, you know, you could fit it on the size of a good desk. You know, it's not big enough to hold tilapia and these other kinds of fish that you could actually eat. We just have goldfish in it, but it's still a representation of free fertilizer and a living system.
I think things like that are so amazing. And
yeah,
that's the kind of thing I want to make right there. It's something that sustains itself, and really you're kind of making a mini version of nature in your house and just creating balance within that. That's saving money on nutrients too.
Oh, that's it. I think balance is the key in all of it. You know, I mean, we've gotten so far out of balance in so many things that we do in modern society in terms of fertilizing our plants or you know, just our perspective and how we go about treating these systems, that if you can kind of hold that idea of balance in your head and operate from that perspective, you're going to get a lot more results in the end out of it. But it's really not as hard as you might think. You know, I was a newbie about 6-8 months ago with aquaponics, and we've had some classes in our store, and it's really encouraging to see the kind of feedback we get from the community, because they all see it as the technology that it really should be. So at this point, it's more about just kind of formalizing it and make it a little more accessible for people. But you can find directions for a simple system online. There's also some amazing YouTube videos of people's setups. You know, just type in aquaponics and, you know, take half an hour and look around. It's pretty amazing what people are doing out there.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. I wish I was closer to your store. I wish I could come in. It sounds like you got some cool stuff going on there.
Yeah, we try to keep it interesting. You know, we live in a small town, which is interesting because it's kind of forced our hand to, you know, think out of the box over the years, and we've really developed a clientele that has come a long way with us. So, it's definitely a fun place to work.
So, I don't know if you ever mentioned the name of your store, and does it have a website for, you know, can people come and, you know, order some hydro equipment or books from you?
Well, they will be in about maybe a week or 2 weeks. We've operated a long time without an e-commerce store and any way to do business online. But our website's progressivegardens.com. That's our retail site. Right now, it's all information. You can actually just can go there and get visuals of, you know, hydroponic systems and, you know, learn all about lighting and a lot of the concepts that we've discussed on the show. But at this point, we don't offer anything for sale on there yet.
Okay, great. Well, I think that's been a great introduction to indoor gardening, and I'm sure we've piqued the interest of a few people out there who might want to go check that out now, and I know I'm going to check it out. Thank you, Evan Folds, for coming back on the show to talk about that and to continue this series.
Yeah, thank you, Evan. Your information is just so valuable, and you are like a walking encyclopedia on everything you'd want to know about. I mean, that's a compliment. Everything you'd want to know about soil and growing, and you're just so knowledgeable, so we really appreciate you.
Well, thank you very much, guys. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'd be happy to come back anytime. So thanks again.
Great. And make sure to check out Evan's website, progressearth.com, right?
Yeah, Progress Earth. We've got a bunch of websites, vortexbrewer.com, progressivegardens.com. You can find information and products on just about all of them, so definitely be in touch.
Great. And I think next week do the show on compost tea, because I'm really excited to hear about that Vortex Brewer.
Yeah, I think that'll be a good one.
Yeah. So, you know, we didn't set the date for that, but next Monday?
Yeah, that works.
Same time? All right, sounds good. So, Carol, tell us what's coming up tomorrow and what else we can expect this month on Food Integrity Now.
Well, we have some exciting shows planned. Tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, we're going to have two of the folks from the Farmageddon movie, which was just released this week. We're going to have Liz Reitzig, and she's pretty amazing, and Sally Fallon of the Weston A. Price Foundation. They're both in the movie. And then the following week, we are going to have two of the producers of the movie The Vanishing Bees, which is a documentary about what's happening with our bees and why. So we're excited to have them. And they are going to be on at a special time on July 5th. It's still going to be on Tuesday, but they're going to be on at 4 p.m. Mountain Time on July 5th. And then the following week, July 12th, we have the folks back on from Project Gulf Impact. And they are going to update us on the state of the Gulf. They have continued their research down there, and they're going to fill us in on the real deal on what's happened to the Gulf and what we can expect over the next several years. So some exciting new shows.
Yeah, there's been so much going on since the Gulf happened that, you know, everyone's completely forgotten about that. And I think it's great that we're going to revisit that.
Yeah, because it's not over. People have just quit talking about it, and mainstream media has quit covering it. But Project Gulf Impact, people have not. So it's going to be a very important show.
Great. We'll make sure to tune in for those. Thanks again, Evan. And you're listening to Food Integrity Now. I'm Matt Spaeth.
And I'm Carol Gravais.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. And thanks for listening. We will talk to you tomorrow. I won't be on the show, but Carol and Susan will. So
yeah.
we will see you then. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and one more thing I wanted to just give out everybody, our website address, which is foodintegritynow.org, and you can find out more information about us and all the shows we do. So thanks for listening. Bye-bye.